Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Around this time yesterday morning, an avalanche struck at Palisades Tahoe Ski Resort outside Truckee on the opening day for a Black Diamond ski lift reserved for expert skiers and snowboarders. One man, identified as 66-year-old Kenneth Kidd, was killed. Three others were injured or caught in the slide. The Sierra Avalanche Center forecasted a considerable possibility of avalanches in the area due to a winter storm with intense snowfall and high winds. But officials at the ski resort said safety crews checked the area over the past several days, doing control work and monitoring the conditions for the opening. To help us make sense of the situation, we have two guests this morning. Andrew Schwartz is the lead scientist at UC Berkeley's Central Sierra Snow Lab, located at Donner Summit, and he's going to explain the conditions in Tahoe. But first, we're going to begin with Brian Hickey. Brian is a longtime reporter at KCRA. He was also born and raised near Tahoe and is a lifelong backcountry adventurer who is very familiar with the conditions and terrain in the Sierra. Good morning, Brian. Thanks for making the time.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
So first off, when I was reading the press release, I mean, it's kind of hard to visualize what the terrain looks like. Can you describe the terrain where the slide occurred?
So from the reports, this is an area called GS Bowl. So as you're going up KT-22, it would be just to the looker's left. If you're on the chairlift, you'd get off the chairlift, you'd hang a left, and then you would drop in. And it sounds like this was triggered right somewhere near the top of GS Bowl. And then the runout carried it all the way out onto the flats. Because if you've seen some of the video of the rescue efforts, there it is pretty, I wouldn't say totally flat terrain, but generally flat compared to where it appears this slide was triggered higher up the mountain. And so it is steep terrain. It's iconic Palisades Tahoe terrain. It's legendary. KT-22 is the lift that if you've ever seen the pictures of people lined up on a powder day, everyone gets there sometimes before the sun comes up to get the coveted first tracks off of KT-22.
So I would imagine you have skied KT-22 before.
Many times. And there was a lot of pent up demand for this lift, as yesterday was the first day of the season for KT-22 to be open. So there was a large celebration going on at the bottom, people excited to get up there, and almost immediately is when this slide was triggered.
Yeah, so on the one hand, for expert skiers and snowboarders like yourself, I mean, this terrain is something, as you mentioned, there's a lot of pent-up demand, but I would also imagine that that also comes with some risks that you mitigate as a skier like yourself. Is it unusual for an avalanche to occur in this area?
I mean, if you look at the numbers, no, this would be considered avalanche terrain. But that is why Palisades Tahoe Ski Patrol goes out and does the monumental efforts that they do every day that we get new snow or even wind transported snow. They will be out there either ski checking it, cutting it, going side to side, trying to trigger an avalanche with just their body weight, or they'll go out there with hand charges, explosives. They also have areas where on the mountain there are remotely detonated. They're called GazX machines that shoot a charge of propane into the snowpack to trigger avalanches in those known paths. So yes, this would be avalanche terrain, but being in bounds, it is controlled terrain, but the control only goes so far as we saw yesterday. Back when I worked in Reno, this was 20 years ago, I'm aging myself a little bit, I had an opportunity to go out with the ski patrol at then Squaw Valley and go out and work the Red Dog Ridge. And so we got on the lift before the sun was even up. It was bitter cold. I was riding up the chairlift with guys who had backpacks full of explosives. And we were trudging through knee-deep snow as they went out there. And this is what they do every day when there's new snow or wind-transported snow.
Hmm. You know, obviously we're familiar with an avalanche, but we might not know the specifics or the nuances of it. I mean, how is an avalanche forecast created? What happens when an avalanche actually takes place?
So they typically occur between 30 and 45 degrees. So if you're a backcountry skier, as I am, that's when you get onto something greater than 30 degrees, you kind of, the hair stands up on your neck a little bit and you're going to take some extra precautions. Either you're going to dig a pit and do what's called a shovel shear test. You're testing the stability of the snow. You're looking for weak layers. And, you know, and beyond that, you're also just kind of studying the terrain. Are you seeing any signs of naturally triggered slides that had already occurred in your area? What was the wind the night before? Things like that. And then, of course, you bring along your safety equipment. I would never go into the backcountry without my beacon, which is an electronic device that allows my partner to find me. A partner is my other key piece of equipment that I would take with me. And then also a shovel and then a probe. If you saw some of the video of yesterday's rescue effort, you saw people with long sticks shoving them into the snow, literally hoping to jab a body to locate somebody.
Hmm. You mentioned the temperature range that makes an avalanche likely. I mean, does the amount of snow also matter, or even the type of snow?
All of that matters. So I kind of missed your question. I'm sorry about that. But you've got the angle, and then you've got the snow. And think of the snow as a layer cake. Every time a new storm comes in, there's going to be different conditions, whether it be the temperature, the snow to the liquid to snow ratio, which I know Andrew will talk about here in a moment. But that snow, they all have the formation. The crystals have different formations, and some bond better with others. Right now, according to the Sierra Avalanche Center, we have a persistent weak layer that formed early in this month. And that layer was formed by something called surface hoar, which is basically a frost that forms on the surface. That can easily go away, but if it doesn't and it gets buried by another layer of snow, that's a pretty loose, slippery layer. And I'll be curious to know in the after they investigate this slide whether or not that persistent weak layer was at the heart of this avalanche.
This also happened as a winter storm was forecasted in the area. I mean, given that you are very familiar with the area, I mean, is it unusual to go skiing during conditions like this?
These are my favorite days. You know, there's usually less people on the mountain. We call it free refills. You go ski a powder run, you come back around, and on a good day, your tracks are gone already. They're already buried by the next run. And so we call that free refills. But again, you take that with a certain level of inherent risk. I generally don't ski with my probe and my shovel inbounds on a powder day, but I have a beacon and I always bring my beacon on a big powder day. Why not? It's about the size of an old Sony Walkman, and you strap it to your chest. You hardly know it's there. And, you know, it would just help somebody locate me if something were to happen, even inbounds. And an inbound slide doesn't have to be a big avalanche. It can be something like a little slough that happens in a gully that maybe patrol didn't get to. It could be something as big as 20 feet long, just enough to throw you off balance and throw you upside down into a tree well, or maybe knock you off balance and throw you off of or into a rock. In many cases, an avalanche is trauma is the cause of death because people are thrown into something of a hazard. And then, of course, there's always the asphyxiation that could happen as well. But trauma is one of the big causes of fatalities.
Have you ever experienced one?
I've been caught in a slide inbounds. This was years ago in Kirkwood, a run called Big Sister. For those of you that know it, it's up off of the wall. You hike across the cliff there. And my buddies and I all raced out to Big Sister, and I was the first to drop in. And what was interesting about this is once I looked up, after studying the slide afterwards, the crown was only about 4 inches. But the whole bowl slid and went down into a funnel. So by the time that 4 inches of snow was funneled, I was shoulder deep in snow, but was lucky enough to have my torso, shoulders, and head up out of snow. But I, at that point, breathed in so much snow, I was choking and coughing. Could have been a lot worse, but it just shows that even a small amount of snow, given the proper terrain, can funnel into something very deep.
You've said inbounds a few times. That means within a ski resort, right?
Within a ski resort, yeah.
As opposed to the backcountry.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the backcountry, you know, a number of small sloughs and things like that. Nothing major, fortunately, knock on wood.
You also mentioned that this lift, KT-22, is like in high demand for expert skiers. You also said that it was kind of unusual that it opened this late in the season. Why is that?
Well, typically we'd have a little more snow. I don't know what the snow totals are right now. Just before New Year's, I think we were sitting around 29%. Perhaps Andrew can elaborate on that, but we're still well below normal. So typically KT would be open a little bit sooner than this. And, you know, honestly, putting people on the mountain actually helps stabilize the mountain. And when you've got a bunch of people skiing, you are constantly ski cutting and compacting that snowpack. And so, again, that also could be a factor here in that you have these different layers that form from these small systems that came through. And then that persistent weak layer, you know, I'm not second guessing any of the decisions that were made at Palisades, but these are just some of the factors that I know exist in the Sierra right now.
I mean, I'm going back to when you experienced a slide. You were the first one to go down. And then yesterday was the opening day of this lift. And so does that create a risk being like the first? I mean, is it better to kind of, I don't know, wait it out? I mean, I understand someone has to be the first, but does a safety change, you know, the longer you wait?
I have never been the first one on the lift and felt bad about that. In fact, that is a privilege to be the first one on a lift and get first tracks. But you do have to keep in mind the inherent risk that you're taking upon yourself. You know, again, the patrol can only do so much and they do a very good job of it. But at the same time, you need to have a buddy and you need to have a plan because sometimes things can go sideways, whether it be the conditions or your own ability.
Finally, Brian, I mean, if you're caught in an avalanche, what kind of steps or actions should people take in the immediacy in the first few seconds?
One thing you'll notice if you study ski patrol, none of them have straps on their poles. And there's a reason for that. And on powder days, I don't ski with my straps. I just hold them under my hands. And the reason being, if you were to be caught in a slide, you can easily jettison your poles and free your hands up and then start doing a swimming motion. You can sometimes kick your skis off, free yourself up so that you can literally swim or try to swim to the top of the snowpack before it sets, before it comes to rest. That'll get you closer to the surface, if anything, hopefully to the surface. And then, you know, again, having the proper equipment. I don't ski in bounds with all of my Abbey gear, but I do ski again with the beacon. And so if I'm with a buddy with a beacon, you know, I can find them. But I would say skiing without your poles, knowing your own ability. I think a far greater risk than avalanche in the resort is tree well entrapment, especially for snowboarders. If you end upside down in a tree well, and there's videos that have been done with expert professionals, expert patrol, one that comes to mind out of Canada recently, where an expert patrolman tried to dig himself out of a tree well upside down and he couldn't do it. And the effort it took to dig him out was incredible. So that is a far greater risk than an avalanche, in my opinion.
We know that avalanches are common, but just given your expertise specifically in this area, when you hear that one happened and that one, you know, took a life, how do you feel? What do you think?
Well, it reminds us that the mountains are in control despite our best efforts to mitigate those risks. I think that anyone who loves skiing and snowboarding, the risk is part of the excitement, at least for me. I'm a little bit of an adrenaline junkie, so... And just that thrill of adventure, that's what the mountains provide us. So, you know, I don't want it to be a completely controlled environment, but, you know, again, the resorts do a great job of maintaining it and making it safe. And I can only imagine those patrollers this morning are second guessing what they did or what they didn't do. And, you know, wondering if there was something more they could do, because I've been with them, as I told you earlier, I've seen the work that they do. It is painstaking. It's bitter cold out there. It's dangerous work that they do. And they do that daily to try to mitigate that hazard for the rest of us. So I can only imagine how they must feel this morning, given the tragedy that happened yesterday.
Brian, thank you so much.
Sure.
Brian Hickey is an expert skier and outdoor adventurer in the Sierra. You can actually watch Brian on KCRA3 as their morning traffic reporter. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we've been discussing the conditions surrounding yesterday morning's deadly avalanche at Palisades Tahoe Resort. Now we're going to welcome Andrew Schwartz from the Central Sierra Snow Lab near Donner Summit. Hey, Andrew.
Good morning, Vicki. How are you doing?
So you joined us about... I'm doing great. Thank you. You joined us about a month ago, and I think a lot has changed since then. Over the past, like, 48 hours or so, you know, what have conditions been like for you?
Well, it started off relatively tame about 2 days ago. We had a little bit of snowfall. Temperatures were starting to fall. But over the last 24 hours is where it really ramped up. About this time yesterday, we were starting to get heavier snowfall rates. Wind speeds were really starting to peak. We were seeing a lot of very high wind speeds blowing snow around. And over the last 24 hours, we've had about 10 inches of snow here at the lab, about 13 inches total over the last 2 days. So it's been a snowy one for sure.
Hmm. When you mentioned, you know, just in the last 24 hours, I mean, 24 hours ago is when that avalanche took place. Can you take us back to what the Tahoe area was experiencing, you know, at this time, weather-wise?
Absolutely. At this time, we actually had some of our heavier snowfall rates starting to move into the area from north of I-80, basically. They were finally starting to move this way. We were starting to see our rates pick up. And at the same time, we were starting to get, we were peaking with our winds. And those winds were kind of coming from a northerly, northwesterly area. So they were basically going out to the east. And when we talk about the Sierra, the reason why we have kind of, you know, drier areas on the east side is because we have that rain shadow. Because when that wind pushes the snow into the top of the peaks, it tends to fall on the west side, and then the dry east side stays dry. So as this is occurring, we were getting a lot of blowing snow up and over the ridges, a lot of very strong winds, which can do things like wind load our snow, which can be potential avalanche factors as well. So it was very, very stormy, very windy, and kind of difficult conditions to be out in.
So basically the eastern slope of the Sierra can be more prone to avalanches if the conditions are right, when you're setting up the wind and also the snow?
If the conditions are right, yeah. So it depends a lot on wind direction. But yeah, we see oftentimes we get like I said, wind loading. So that's basically where wind will deposit a lot of snow in one area, typically over a ridge or on opposite side of trees or things like that. So it doesn't always necessarily have to happen on the east side, but in these conditions, that's probably where it was highest. Mm.
In addition to avalanches and just there's limited visibility over the summit on I-80, what other dangers have built up or can build up, you know, when storms like this take place?
In addition to what you mentioned, kind of just travel and being out in avalanche style conditions, the big thing here with recent storms has been our wind chills. When we talk about these very strong winds and the fact that these last couple storms have been colder than average, we can see wind chills that might be around zero or even below zero on some of these ridges and crests, where it can only take, you know, a few minutes for frostbite to form on exposed skin. So that's one of the issues. But of course, the big thing is when you're out trying to travel in these conditions, whether that be on foot or in your car, you know, there's a reason the National Weather Service typically tells you to stay home when we're expecting these big storms, because if you end up getting yourself stuck in any way or getting into a problematic situation, it becomes much more dire if you're not well equipped with things like blankets and warm clothing and the emergency necessities.
Yeah, I have been in whiteout conditions, as I know Brian Hickey has as well. So we understand that and relay that as well. You know, given that you joined us in December, it was kind of lackluster at that time. I mean, the snowpack was only around a third of average. I mean, it wasn't obviously set in stone yet. A lot can happen. Now, several weeks, storms later, where do things stand today?
Well, we're sitting better. I don't want to, you know, just keep harping on doom, doom, doom as far as our snowpack. We are doing better. Since the first of the year, we've seen our snowpack over double compared to what it was. And that's fantastic news. Right now at the snow lab, we're at 53% of our average snow water equivalent, which is up from about 30%. Statewide, we're at 37% of average. So we are better. One of the problems, though, is that we started the year so dry that the storms that are coming in are just kind of keeping us roughly where we're at. So if we're talking 40 to 50% of average, these storms are kind of just keeping us in that area. They're not really pulling us out and getting us closer to average at all. We really need something with 3, 4, 5 feet, you know, or back-to-back big storms to really start making up for that lack of snow that we had early in the season. So have we been getting snow? Yes. And that's a great thing, because we're not becoming even more dry by not getting it, but we're not necessarily making up ground either.
You mentioned in December that these colder systems in terms of snowfall were really kind of heading more north, like Northern California to the Pacific Northwest. Is that still the case?
That is, yeah. So we see the most of most of our snowfall occur in the northern part of the state, and that's being reflected in our snowpack too. So for instance, in the northern Sierra and up to the Oregon border, we're about 40% of our average snowpack to date. Here in the central Sierra, we're about 38%, and down south they're hurting a lot more than we are. They're 29%. So those storm systems are going further up north right now. We are catching the southern edge of them, and we've been seeing a little bit more than we did earlier in the season. But so far, yeah, we're not sitting directly in the line of fire like we were last year when we were at 223% of average for this date.
Andrew, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Andrew Schwartz is a lead scientist at UC Berkeley's Central Sierra Snow Lab. It is located at Donner Summit, updating us on the recent winter storm in Tahoe. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We have talked about California's projected budget shortfall, but the governor's office is painting a rosier picture when it comes to deficits. Last month, the legislative analyst's office projected a $68 billion shortfall. But yesterday, Governor Newsom announced, according to his own financial analysts, that the budget hole is closer to $38 billion, which is nearly half. So how did we get such a big difference just 5 weeks apart? Regardless, when it comes to spending, cuts, scaling back, tightening, shuffling, whatever you want to call it, it needs to happen before the fiscal year starts on July 1st. In a few moments, we're going to hear from economist Wayne Weingarten. But first, CAP Radio state politics reporter Nicole Nixon was at the press briefing about the new budget shortfall and joins us with more about how the state is going to close the gap. Hey, Nicole.
Hello.
So before we dive into this $30 billion discrepancy between two financial departments, it is important to know that there are two fiscal arms within the state. There's the Department of Finance, which is under the governor's office, and then the LAO's office, legislative analyst office, which is part of the state legislature. So how are these two different?
Well, the legislative analyst's office advises the legislature. They're nonpartisan. They collect a lot of data and give policy recommendations and fiscal recommendations. They are where that $68 billion deficit number came from. And the Department of Finance is part of the administration. And, you know, they advise the governor. The difference between these two numbers comes down to a few things. And it's like they can use the same data and they use different formulas to arrive at these numbers. And one example is the LAO suggested that one thing the legislature and the governor might do to fill this giant $68 billion deficit, as they projected, is to go back to last year's budget, reopen the books, because those revenues came in so much lower than they were projected, it affected, you know, what the state actually has to work with. So they could go back and they could correct sort of the school funding. And that would affect the minimum requirement for school funding this year. And that's about an $8 billion difference. So the LAO, that's a policy decision. That is something that the legislature would have to do. So the LAO did not account for that. They said, here's something you might do. Now, Newsom's Department of Finance assumed, yes, we're going to do that. So that's one of the differences here. And there are a few of those different things. The Department of Finance also had a bit more optimistic picture of an estimate of revenues that will continue to come in. The LAO, again, put this report out in December. I don't think they included the December revenues that came in, and the Department of Finance did. So there are a few things to account for these sort of different numbers.
And we have to take into account and just remind people that this was an unprecedented situation because of winter storms early last year. It delayed the tax filing for a majority of counties
right.
in California.
I mean, the storms from 1 year ago, you know, the very beginning of 2023 are having this impact still on the state's ability to forecast its own budget because the tax day was delayed from April to October and then delayed again from October to November. So it really screwed with the state's ability to count what's in its own bank accounts. Mm.
Within the past few years, I mean, we have gone from large, even record surpluses to budget shortfalls in the tens of billions, and that's where we're at now. These are just dramatic pendulum swings. And Governor Newsom yesterday, just right off the bat, said something to the effect of, like, this is a story of correction, story of normalization, you know, after unprecedented disruption, something like that. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hallmark of California's tax revenue system is volatility. And because the state relies so heavily on higher earners, we have a progressive tax system, as it's called. That means if you earn less, you're taxed at a lower rate. If you earn more, you're taxed at a higher rate, up to like 13% of your income is taxed if you earn over a certain amount. Because of that, the top 1% of earners contribute much, much more to the state's coffers. So a few years ago, the top 1% of earners in California were contributing 50% of the entire general fund income tax revenue of the state. So when those earners have a down year, when they have a good year, that number gets really, really high. And that is why we had such big surpluses, $70 billion in 2021, $100 billion in 2022.
And there was also one-time funding from COVID, right?
Exactly.
From the federal government.
Yeah. And you know, when they do well, the state does well. When they don't do as well, the state does not do as well. So, yeah, as you said, here's Newsom. We can listen to him describe this as a normalization.
This is a story of correction and normalcy, and one that we, in some respects, anticipated, the acuity, perhaps not, and one we're certainly prepared to work through.
And he's just, you know, pointing out the fact that on the one hand, this has happened. I mean, this happened after the dot-com bust. This happened after the Great Recession. And on the other hand, we weren't quite sure how bad it was going to be because the tax filing date was moved so late last year.
Well, regardless, the reality is there's tens of billion dollars. There's a shortfall. So, you know, changes have to be made. Revisions have to be made. He also led with, like, keeping promises to core issues from homelessness, public safety, public education, climate, infrastructure. How is all this possible?
Well, thankfully, the state has a rainy day fund to dip into to help keep some of these programs funded. So there's $20-something billion in that rainy day fund. Newsom wants to draw down about half of that. So $13 billion in budget reserves that can fill about a third of this budget deficit. Like he said, that, you know, he's going to prioritize things like homelessness, public safety, education, and promises that he's made to keep those things going.
When it comes to the rainy day fund, I remember this going back to, like, Governor Brown, when I'd go to his, you know, presentations for the budget and, like, the piggy bank, you know, diagram that he would show. Is it significant that Newsom is pulling from the rainy day fund?
I think so, because, you know, on the one hand, they were having a conversation last year. There was a $32 billion deficit about whether to break into that rainy day fund that grew basically from zero in 2020 up to 20. I'm forgetting the exact number, $28 billion or something in there like that in there now. So last year, he resisted dipping into the rainy day fund, even though there was a deficit. He said, I don't want to do this unless we enter a recession. Neither the LAO nor the Department of Finance is projecting that we are in a recession now or that we will enter into one this year. So the fact that he is saying, yes, now let's do this, let's pull from the rainy day fund, I think is significant.
When it comes to cuts that are actually going to take place, I mean, who are the biggest losers so far? I mean, and the response from them?
Yeah, cuts under Newsom's budget proposal include some climate programs, climate equity programs that deal with, like, decarbonization, extreme heat in under-resourced neighborhoods would get cuts. Also, subsidies for clean air programs and residential solar. Advocates are not happy about this, as you can imagine. But on the other hand, the governor is saying we're doing more on climate than any other state. So I think both of those things can be true, that Newsom is saying we're doing a lot. We're getting help from the federal government even on climate programs. But advocates say, with the state of climate change in the world, especially as California builds itself as a leader, we should be doing more.
Arguably, the biggest issue in our state is homelessness, and there has been a record amount of spending. Will there be any cuts to that? Or, I mean, how is he going to still work on solving this crisis, reducing it at least, you know, during a deficit?
Yeah, I think some of that remains to be seen. He is preserving $1 billion in flexible grants for cities and counties to address homelessness. Those are called HAP grants, and those were promised last year. I think they're in a process where cities and counties can apply for those now, but those will be preserved. There were a few housing programs that looked to be getting cuts, and that's led to kind of a mixed response from local governments on this budget, because on the one hand, there's these housing or homelessness grants that they really appreciate, but housing programs also may be on the chopping block.
Also, his tone really struck me. I watched the press conference. I mean, he just made it clear he wasn't happy with how the budget deficit in December was initially covered, as well as other reporting from national outlets, particularly the editorial board of The Wall Street Journal. I mean, given that you were there in person, how would you describe his demeanor?
I guess, fed up in some respects. A few different people described it as spicy to me. And like you said, there were these two issues. So the first was about the size of the budget deficit. Obviously, the LAO came out with this shocking $68 billion number last month, and that's the number that the public had, and that's the number that's been reported. Newsom has signaled that his intel is that the number is different, and we finally saw that number yesterday. So I think he really wanted to correct that the record and like put out what his Department of Finance is telling him, but he wasn't able to until this presentation. And then there's this issue with a wealth tax that really set him off. And let's back up here for some context. The legislature there was a bill in the legislature to impose a tax on the assets of Californians who are worth more than $50 million. That bill was introduced last year. It never got a hearing. There's a new speaker now, though, and I guess his policy is that bills get heard and they get public hearings. So he's pushing committee chairs to hold hearings for bills, even if they may not necessarily agree with them. And that's kind of a different leadership style of the assembly speaker, the prior one and the current one. So this wealth tax bill appeared on a legislative committee agenda this week, and that caused some headlines, including an editorial from The Wall Street Journal that Newsom did not like. He was maybe understandably annoyed that the editorial from The Wall Street Journal included a photo of him for that piece. And, you know, he's said for several years that he does not support broad tax increases, definitely not a wealth tax. So he was irked about that editorial going into the presentation. He talked for about an hour. He mentioned a couple times that he's not supporting a wealth tax. And then a reporter asked about it, and it kind of sent him. So let's listen.
I don't know how many times I have to. I'm just not going to say it again because I say it every single year. It's infuriating because I guess everybody needs the same story and needs to regurgitate the story. Maybe you guys have some advice for me. Honestly, so no is the answer.
He kind of sounded like a dad at his wit's end there, I think.
Yeah, he sounded irritated. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're diving into the revised budget projections for the upcoming fiscal year, which currently stands at a projected $38 billion budget shortfall. I now want to welcome Wayne Weingarten, who is a senior fellow in business and economics at the Pacific Research Institute, which works advanced free market solutions. Welcome, Wayne.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Welcome back. Well, it's well understood that California was anticipating a budget shortfall. This was even before the LAO's projection last month. Were you surprised that the governor's projections were far less than the legislative analyst's office?
I guess I was a little surprised. I think we did a really nice job in terms of describing what the discrepancy was. And it is important to know these are estimates. These aren't the actuals. We don't really know. So I think one thing we know for sure is both of these estimates are probably wrong. The deficit is it's somewhere around those. And the volatility of the tax revenues had made this difficult to forecast for this year. Having said that, when you look at the latest report from the controller in terms of how much cash has come in second half of the year, if you look at the withholdings, and the LAO had a publication out just a couple of days ago looking at income tax withholdings, those are still disappointing. And so I think, you know, we definitely need to keep our guard up because while the government says we received more from kind of the last year, we're still seeing disappointments in kind of the current tax revenues. And so as we get through the budget process and we'll eventually get to the May revision, all of these are going to start kind of interacting with one another, and we'll see where they net out. I think the one thing we know for certain, though, is even if the governor was 100% correct on this $38 billion, that is a historically difficult, large deficit that we need to close. Hmm.
What was the big message you took away from the governor's solutions to close this projected gap?
Well, I mean, I guess to be optimistic, it's something I think that it's commendable for the governor is that he's not proposing tax increases. He's recognizing that, you know, this is on the expenditure side, and that's where we need to focus. A lot of the actually about 2/3 of his solutions, when you take away the reserves, which is proper use of the rainy day fund, about 2/3 of it are things like budget shifts, where they'll say, as opposed to accounting that spending this year, we're going to push it off to next year. There's, I think, a couple billion dollars, I think it's five, the University of California system and the Cal State, that they're not going to get it this year, although they can borrow against it, but that'll come next year. And so what I find disconcerting about, you know, if two-thirds of that part of the solution is pushing things off to next year, if you look at our budget history, these typically aren't 1 to 2 year events. And so if we have another budget problem next year, which I think is prudent to expect, then all of a sudden we've reduced our reserves by more than half. And then we've taken spending from this year and we've piled it onto next year, which means that next year we're going to have an even larger problem. So I think, you know, it's prudent to look more where can we create savings? Where can we find efficiencies? Where can we do better for less? And I think that's an important mantra that we need to actually put.
Nicole talked about the volatility in our state when it comes to the budget, and there are these dramatic budget pendulum swings, largely due to how the state generates revenue, depending heavily on the highest income Californians, the top 1%. Do you think there needs to be a reform so that the state has a more consistent, reliable budget outlook to be just more effective?
Absolutely. I mean, if you and this problem goes back to the 1970s. And if you look at it, it's just a typical pattern where you see during the good times, because of that, the progressive tax system, revenue surging. And as opposed to really looking at what's our affordable level of government, how much of that surge should we not be spending? And, you know, we ramp up our spending to match that accelerated spending level. And then eventually when kind of the economy sputters, and history shows the economy will sputter, we have one of these crashes, and it happens again and again and again. And what you find is, until we get that expenditure control back, until we see a bit of income growth because the economy recovers, and that typically happens somewhere around where tax revenues are about 7.5-8% of our income, then we can actually kind of, we get back on the roller coaster and the process continues. The problem is, typically when you have some of the kind of unsustainable budgets, you're spending about 9% of personal income somewhere. Right now we're at 10, I think we fall down to about 9.8, 9.5%, but we're at a much kind of bigger peak than normal, which actually does kind of support where the LAO deficit position is. So we really are looking at a huge drop from kind of the tax revenue relative to income to where we need to get to. And that's really a prolonged crisis. There are lots of things we can be doing, thinking about how can we accelerate income growth to kind of cushion that fall. But without that, we are talking about some severe expenditure control for several budget cycles.
You mentioned that, you know, when it comes to these budget shortfalls, they usually aren't these isolated, you know, 1 year incidents or even 2 year incidents. The governor yesterday said that although the projections from the LAO and the Department of Finance were differed greatly, that both agencies did not see a recession looming. Would you agree with that?
You know, it's always easier to forecast the past than the future. But I'm a little more pessimistic about the economy. I think we'll see over the next several months whether that happens. Even if we have, if we avoid a recession, what we really need in terms of solving the budget problem here is a huge acceleration, an acceleration in capital gains. So the stock market's doing well, which means the economy is booming. So there's really two parts to that question. One, which is, are we going to avoid a recession or not? Which, you know, that. The other thing is, are we going to have a huge boom? Mm. And so I think, yeah, even if we are forecasting that we're going to avoid a recession, if we're not going to have that accelerated growth, we're not going to see the revenue surge needed to kind of match where the expenditure levels currently are. And so that in itself is disconcerting.
Nicole, in the last 30 seconds that we have, I mean, this is just really obviously the beginning. There is a lot that can happen between now and the May revise. What are you looking for?
Well, the legislature's response to this, they will have some hearings over the next few months to dig into this. And then, of course, Newsom and legislative leaders are negotiating behind closed doors as well. I think it'll be interesting to see in May what the deficit number is at that point, because, then it's after tax day. They have more a clearer picture of the state's actual revenues. So if it gets bigger, you know, what are they looking at?
Nicole and Wayne, thanks for the conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Wayne Weingarten is a senior fellow in business and economics at the Pacific Research Institute, and Nicole Nixon is our state politics reporter. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Opera Modesto is turning the stereotype of going to the opera upside down. This weekend, it is debuting its world premiere production of Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Fallen Giant. It's a mashup of two famous fairy tales, Jack and the Beanstalk and Sherlock Holmes.
If magic is speaking, it's headed for London. We must stop it now. I wish to
In addition to the two shows this Saturday and Sunday, Opera Modesto is also taking the show on the road to over 4,000 students in three counties as part of its Story into Song Literacy initiative. Joining us are Opera Modesto General Director Roy Stevens, composer Evan Meyer, and librettist E.M. Ellen Lewis. Welcome.
Good morning. It's great to be back on Insight with you, Vicky.
Thank you for having us.
All right, Roy.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have all three of you. Roy, I want to start with you. Tell us what makes Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Fallen Giant so unique.
Well, first of all, Opera Modesto loves to do traditional opera, but we also really want to bring opera to new audiences, to students, to educational possibilities, and to family audiences. And this is so unique because it brings two really popular stories that are unexpectedly mixed up together. Who would have thought of Sherlock Holmes being involved with Jack and the Beanstalk? Well, apparently, E.M. Lewis and Evan Meyer, and the result is delightful and fun.
Yeah, Ellen and Evan are working in tandem. Ellen, you're a lyricist or a librettist. I learned something new today. Evan is the composer of this production. How did you guys collaborate to make this mashup, you know, a reality?
Oh, well, we met in American Lyric Theater's Composer-Librettist Development Program in New York City, and they're the ones who commissioned this new opera, so they sort of put us together. But we've been working for the last, what, 7 or 8 years, Evan, on on this project. It's a big one.
Evan, what excites you about actually seeing this come to life this weekend?
Well, so we've previously only seen non-staged performances of the opera or a production with college students at Portland State University. And now we see it on a much larger scale. We get to see our ideas come to life and the different creative interpretations that our wonderful director is putting together and all the contributions of the singer. So it's really great as a composer to see that come to life.
Yeah. In what aspects does the music that you're composing, it really adds to telling of the story?
Well, there are a few elements that we played on. One is the fairy tale element. So there are moments of the opera that meant to invoke a world of mystery and wonder and magic. And then there's also the element of a magic harp, which we have. And this magic harp is from the Jack and the Beanstalk story. And in our piece, it gives magical musical clues to Sherlock Holmes, who's a musician in the Conan Doyle canon. So it plays operatic excerpts, and then Holmes interprets these and uses them to solve the mystery.
Vicky, I'm sure you knew that Sherlock Holmes is a huge opera fan.
I do now. Thanks, Roy. Well, Roy, I was going to turn to you next because I want to give listeners a taste of the performance that's going to be premiering this weekend. We're going to play a clip, but I want you to set it up first.
Sure. So obviously the word Sherlock Holmes evokes all this logical image of the opera and the storyline. But what's really surprising is that the most human element in the opera are the two giants, Merrily and Blunderbore. And they are beautiful, beautiful characters. And at the end of the opera, they have an incredible duet that's so beautiful and moving, makes me cry every time. They are the human characters that show anger and passion and love and forgiveness and frustration in a way that we humans do all the time. And so I'm not going to give away all the secrets of the story because you got to come and see it to find out. But at this moment, Blunderbore is apologizing. The giant is apologizing for being human, for being frustrated, for being angry and scaring Merrily and other people.
Yeah, Roy, we're talking about giants, but it's something that is very human, right? Grief, anger, love, also forgiveness. You know, obviously it's premiering this weekend, but you're also taking it on the road for thousands of students. Talk to us, Roy, about the Story into Song Literacy, the initiative that y'all have.
Yes, this was an idea that wasn't ours, but we were happy to run with it. It was a board member's idea who thought it would be wonderful to use opera, because it's based on all these amazing stories and literature sources, to use it as a tool to help literacy advocates in the Central Valley to do their work, to help literacy improve rates of literacy. As we all know, illiteracy is a real problem in the Central Valley, probably everywhere. But even if you're in the tech industry and don't think you're interested in music or anything like that, you still have to be able to read. And reading is a real problem. And how many of us remember worksheets passionately from elementary school? Not very many. But almost all of us remember live theater as somehow making a difference in our lives. Even if we hated the show, we loved the memory of it. And so we wanted to leverage stories or books that are read in school and put them on stage in an operatic form with great voices, great performers in live theater, and blow the kids' minds, have them read the stories ahead of time, use our free curriculum companion, and then go back afterwards and read the stuff again because it's different than they remembered when it's on stage, and then read more and use it to make them read more and more. So that's the idea. So we are taking this on the road. The last few years we've done this and performed it for students, 2000 last year in our Edgar Allan Poe Literacy Initiative shows. But this year we wanted to take it to more students that wouldn't be able to come to Modesto. So we are going to 5 cities, community theaters, and performing for 4,000 plus kids, second through 12th grades, who will have their minds blown, their imaginations expanded, and hopefully be excited about reading more and more.
Well, Roy, Evan, and Ellen, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited for this world premiere, kicking off on Saturday as well as Sunday at 2 p.m.
That's right.
At the State Theater in Modesto. State Theater in Modesto. Thank you so
Everybody
much.
Everybody come see it.
Yes. And we have all of the information on our Insight page as well, so it's easy to find. That is Opera Modesto General Director Roy Stevens, composer Evan Meyer, and librettist E.M. Ellen Lewis. The production of Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Fallen Giant premieres this weekend. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to reach out to us, you can send us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here after the holiday on Tuesday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.